my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. Well-dressed man, waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in the noose. Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. This place ain't doing me any good. Town should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts for the dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge. Lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen. I'm only passing through. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain. Used to care, but things have changed. Walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Some days are too hard to touch, but human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but I've changed. Just don't show it. You can hurt someone, not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make that mistake. Some people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here, Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 3rd of September, 2018. It's Monday, Labor Day. You're listening to Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 5 minutes after 8 a.m. Arizona time. We're going to continue our block of instruction when we left off last Monday. We're talking about the failures in the war of the fleet, specifically about Magsaysay and the Hucks in the Philippines, the price for the British victory in Malaya, and why the communists lost in Greece. Have some border news. Things have, I don't know, it might have been because of the moon was in the full cycle last couple of weeks or so. But there's just been constant mayhem going on south of the border. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. And thanks for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. This is the past the bottom or half of the year, and always have a fun drive to collect the money they're required to pay for the bandwidth. And so since we're past the 6 month mark, trying to get that going. As I understand, if you pay it ahead of time, then it's only half of what it could be. So there's a reason for this, and trying not to wait until the last minute. My email address is altabeeb762@hotmail.com, altabeeb762@hotmail.com. I send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette. And also as a reminder that also broadcast on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday, starting at the same time, but it's 2 hours on Thursday, 2 hours on Friday. So since this is kind of a new audience, started at some of the basic parts of about insurgency, what it is, type method, that it's a political struggle and not a military one, and the different parts. And now we're going through some of the case studies of different insurgent movements, because Mao's analogy of the gorilla swimming like a fish in the sea of the population is so often repeated because it contains an essential truth, because it expresses accurately as well as picturesquely the fundamental principle of guerrilla war. If we carry the analogy a step further and ask what happens when the fish is removed or removes himself from the water, and the answer explains better than a treatise the reason for the failure of a few guerrilla movements that have been successfully suppressed. The destruction in 1949 of the Greek communist guerrilla forces of the Democratic Army is a prime example. Malaya is another. And the Huck insurrection in the Philippines is perhaps a third. Because all three show what happens when guerrillas cut off or deliberately cut themselves off. We discussed a tad bit about the guerrillas in the Greek communists, the Hucks and Magsaysay, making comparisons to, you know, what was going on, because they certainly were well organized when they were fighting the Japanese during World War II. They captured quite a few arms from the Japanese, and they were also supplied by the United States. And then also in post-war Malaya, a situation radically different from the Philippines, despite certain obvious similarities, because there was a strong communist guerrilla movement, as in the Philippines, and it had been schooled by experts, including Chin Peng, the Secretary General of the Malayan Communist Party, and he had been described during the war as Britain's most trusted guerrilla. And some 200 party members had learned irregular war a few years earlier in the British Army Special Training School in Singapore. And it's kind of interesting on how the three areas, the Philippines, Malaya, and French Indochina, how they had had political subversives, guerrillas, that were fighting the Japanese. The terrain was similar in all three of those countries, mountains, jungle, coastal, seas. And then what happened? We've kind of been discussing those parts of about how some were successful and some weren't. Now, when we come to Greece, the case history of another sort. Now, the three-year Greek Revolution, successfully put down by the rightist government with the help of the British and the United States, it offers instruction on those interested in knowing how not to conduct a guerrilla war. In Greece in 1946-1949, virtually all the lessons of experience were ignored. All the rules laid down by the Marxist-Leninist theoreticians of revolutionary war were broken by the very communists who might have been expected to adhere most closely to them. Now, as in other areas, the conclusion of World War II in Greece left the communist leaders in an advantageous position, materially and politically. Communism and anti-fascism were closely identified because it was the communists who had dominated the ELAS resistance movement. And thus the party held a strong ideological position. Thousands of the ELAS veterans were at the disposal of the revolutionary movement. And although the ELAS had made a token surrender of its weapons in 1945, the best of the arms supplied to the resistance groups by the British and Americans during the war remained in the hands of the guerrillas when the Civil War broke out in 1946. And although the communist guerrillas were numerically weak, with perhaps 2,500 fighting men in 1946, as opposed to a national gendarmerie of 30,000, and a good start was made, and the recruits to the communist cause poured in. Now, the fighting began in northern mountains along Greek's common border with Albania, Yugoslavia, and Bulgaria. And then it soon spread to south-central Greece and then into the mountains of the Peloponnesus. And the reprisals taken by extreme right-wing groups added fuel to the flame, spreading the conflict. And the communist campaign was initiated along theoretically sound lines. The Democratic Army fought in guerrilla fashion, small units capable of dispersing and hiding or even mingling with the civilian population when in trouble. Yet they were able to concentrate locally superior forces swiftly for attacks on village police outposts and small patrols. And as the guerrillas grew stronger, the police were forced to abandon the small posts and to withdraw for safety into the larger towns. Now, the Athens government, seeing the danger, hastily began to rebuild the army, which had been reduced to virtually nothing during the German occupation. Now, the troops sent into the mountains to subdue the guerrillas encountered the same tactics. They were unable to hold small posts, unable to move freely except in considerable strength. Worse still, they were unable to maintain sufficient force along the northern borders to prevent the passage of men and supply trains from Albania and Yugoslavia, where some 4,000 ELAS veterans had gone when the German occupation had ended. Thus, the Democratic Army could depend on an inviolate rear area across the border in which to establish hospitals, training camps, and supply bases, and the supplies moving into Greece by two main routes, one directly from Yugoslavia and the other from Yugoslavia to Albania and then southward. Of the military strategy under Greek guerrillas has been correctly defined as neither defensive nor offensive, but evasive. In short, it was the war of the flea, a nip here, a bite there, and a quick retreat. And the object was to bleed the army, and through it, the Athens government. And the military objectives were subordinated to political goals, because by cutting communications, sowing civil disorder, increasing the tax burden enormously, disrupting the economic life of the country, the communists reasonably hoped to undermine the Athens regime and to create social, economic, and political pressure that would, in time, bring about its collapse. Now, in the field, the campaign went well, perhaps too well. The small bands of guerrillas grew rapidly. By early 1947, the Democratic Army was fighting in battalion strength. A year later, brigades were formed, and then entire divisions, eight in all, organized roughly along the lines of conventional military divisions. The Democratic Army's initial strength had been about 2,500 at its peak. It reached 26,000, later declining to some 18,500 towards the end of the war. Now, early success and other factors, the support given Athens by the British and then by the Americans, and that given the Democratic Army by the three communist countries north of the border, led to serious, indeed fatal, errors. Now, the first was to lose effective contact with the Greek population. For reasons relating perhaps partly to political security, partly to simple material expedience, the communists early in the campaign began to raid the villages from which the gendarmes had been driven and to strip them of their cattle, their food supplies, and eventually of their inhabitants, the latter being either forcibly inducted into the Democratic Army or driven out of the guerrilla base areas entirely. Hordes of refugees from the war zones created something of a problem for Athens, but at heavy cost politically to the communists. In terms of prestige and popular support throughout Greece, there was also military consequences. With the civil population in the war zone, the government had to think twice about bombing villages and scattered dwellings. Civilians presented a serious problem of target identification to government pilots, who could not always know whether they were strafing a guerrilla mule supply train or a group of farmers on their way to market. But with the war zone emptied of all but combatants, the bomber pilots, as well as the troops on the ground, had a free hand, anything that moved, except government soldiers whose positions were known, was automatically a target. Now, the second major blunder of the Democratic Army, made for reasons still not entirely clear, was to begin in 1947 to try to hold ground, adopting conventional defensive tactics for which their inferior numbers, light arms, and weak logistical system were entirely unsuited. The guerrillas had grown strong. 18,000 to 26,000 men is a formidable force for guerrillas. They were, however, obviously no match in any clear test of strength against an army and a National Defense Corps, which together commanded some 265,000 men supported by armor, artillery, and a more than adequate air force. Political considerations apparently entered into the communist decision to attempt to transition from guerrilla warfare to a more conventional operation. Now, first, the use of troops in brigade and division strength, then the attempt to hold ground in the north. A communist government had been formed, and it required a territorial base. If world recognition was to be sought for a free Greece, it had to be demonstrated that such a Greece existed. And no doubt, other factors bore on the decision. The communists certainly needed, and in any case, would have been reluctant to dispense with their foreign bases and the supplies that came by mule train from Yugoslavia. To keep the borders open may have been one of the objects of the Democratic Army's defensive operations in the north. Mistaken or not, the Democratic Army was at first successful in holding ground. In the summer of 48, 12,000 to 15,000 communist troops held off 50,000 government soldiers for 2.5 months in the Gramos Mountains, over an area of some 200 square miles. When the pressure became too great, the Democratic Army withdrew into Albania, only to reappear in the Mount Vitsi region to the northeast, where a successful defense was made against renewed army operations. Within 6 months, the guerrillas had again established themselves in the Gramos, and the government campaign in the north was, for the time being, defeated. The defeat forced Athens to take drastic steps. General Alexander Papagos, former chief of the Army General Staff, was recalled from retirement and given what amounted to a free hand in reorganizing the army, with the authority to raise its strength to 250,000, if necessary. Unsuitable officers were replaced by Papagos, and new aggressive tactics were adopted. 25,000 men were thrown into battle in Peloponnesus, where the communists had seized the offensive. By early 49, the 3,600 guerrillas in that area had been liquidated, and the army was making good progress against those in central Greece. By the end of June, the Democratic Army had been defeated almost everywhere except in the Gramos and Mount Vitsi strongholds, and a strong offensive against these positions was in preparation. Now, the communists, meanwhile, had been dealt a severe blow by the vagaries of international politics. Tito had fallen out with Stalin. Yugoslavia had left the cuneiform, and in July, the Belgrade government closed its border with Greece. Yugoslavia's action cut the guerrilla supply line into Macedonia and western Thrace, isolating some 4,000 communist reserves in Yugoslavia and driving a wedge between the main force of communists in the Gramos Vitsi area and the guerrillas in Bulgaria, eastern Macedonia, and Thrace, some 5,000 in all. The Democratic Army was still able to obtain some supplies from Albania, but far fewer and of poor quality than had come from Yugoslavia. Laboring against these difficulties, the Democratic Army proved unable long to resist better armed, better trained, and organized regular troops in vastly superior numbers and with full artillery and air support. Within 3 days in August, the Mount Vitsi force of 7,000 was overrun, and 5,000 guerrillas fled north into Albania. The government offensive in the Gramos lasted 5 days. And by the time it was over, 4,000 more guerrillas, the last remnants of the Democratic Army, had also withdrawn into Albania, and for all practical purposes, the civil war in Greece was at an end. And although thousands of erstwhile guerrillas and many more thousands of collaborators remained at large scattered across the country, the revolution was destroyed beyond any hope of resurrection. Now, it seems not unfair to say that, to a very great extent, it was destroyed by the communists themselves, their alienation from the civil population in the northern mountains, the terrorism practiced against civilians, their dependence on foreign bases and supplies, and their premature decision in 48 to hold ground and expose large formations to numerically, technologically, logistically, and organizationally superior army cost them a series of defeats from which there was no recovery. And their loss was twofold. They were defeated military, and the Greek army success spelled defeat for the revolutionary movement politically as well. Now, in the Greek context, the revolutionary principle fears repetition. The object of the guerrilla is not to win battles, but to avoid defeat. Not to end the war, but to prolong it until political victory, more important than any battlefield to victory, has been won. Because in sacrificing the advantages of guerrilla tactics for military strategy based on territorial investment, the Greek communists exposed strength within weakness. Because in risking a military confrontation, they gambled not only their available manpower, but something more important, their political prestige as a revolutionary force able to defy by skillful evasion and superior tactics the military colossus. And in losing the gamble, they lost the essential momentum, the high sense of popular anticipation, the bandwagon effect on which the success of any political movement depends. Revolution is by definition a mass phenomenon. Greek, Malaya, the Philippines all illustrate the axiom that without mass participation or at least popular support, there can be no revolution. The Huts lost it. The Chinese and Malaya never had it, and the Greek communists threw it away. I'll let you think about that one for a little while. We're down here at the bottom of the hour. Got about 1 or 2 minutes until the break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Sun Tzu on the art of war, the principles of guerrilla strategy and tactics, terrain as a determining factor on guerrilla war in urban areas, and the character of the guerrilla. Now, I know I come along here, and it's a wee small voice that nobody's heard of. Who is this guy telling us that our guns are our most worthless piece of equipment? Who is this guy saying it's not guerrilla war, it's a political war? Well, so not only do I come on with the interview of Jeffrey Bennett years and years ago and started talking about insurgency and what it is, and initially there was a lot of opposition. Boy, everybody wanted me off of there by the bottom of the hour. But then we came back, and by the end of the hour, everybody was in the chat room asking, Jeff, when are you going to bring this guy back up? Because you can sit here and try to reinvent the wheel, but it's already been invented. It's already been demonstrated on the principles of guerrilla warfare, on the principles of insurgency. Like it or not, the guerrilla holds the upper hand, but sometimes the guerrilla gets, a little too big for their britches, and the population that they depend on, they start terrorizing the population and lose that base that they depend on economically, logistically, intelligence, a number of things, and how it is. We're working on a new study about the pen and the sword of psy war ops, psychological warfare operations, psychological warfare, and MISO, the military information system operations. It's quite interesting. It goes into a case study on the use of psychological, the information aspect of it, and how it has been used so successfully. Major General Sir Frank Kitson and Sir Robert Thompson and Edward Lansdale on the parts and pieces about psychological warfare. And the study is quite in-depth, going back as to where the origin of the word propaganda came up out of, right after the printing press was invented, and to propagate the message, and how during the World War I and World War II, the printed word and the broadcast radio was used extensively, but after that it kind of didn't really stay around. Some of the units had been disbanded and some of them were consolidated, but now with the current events in Iraq and Afghanistan, people are really starting to become aware of the proper use of psychological warfare operations. So when we finish up our study of the guerrilla, then we'll start in that. Oh, and quite a bit about David Galula, counterinsurgency tactics theory and practice, and the military information support operations, MISO. That's the new word that has replaced psychological warfare operations, PSYWAR ops, PSYOPs. So I'm not exactly sure of so many options coming up here, because we're pretty much wrapping up our study in guerrilla warfare and insurgency and the war of the flea right now. Well, we got the bottom of the hour break coming in here, as it's no fun being an illegal alien. We'll be right back. Don't go nowhere. Well, that's for sure. It's no fun being an illegal alien. In the Greek context, the revolutionary principle bears repetition. The object of the guerrilla is not to win battles, but to avoid defeat. Not to end the war, but to prolong it until political victory, more important than any battlefield victory, has been won. In sacrificing the advantages of guerrilla tactics for military strategy based on territorial investment, the Greek communists oppose strength with weakness. In risking a military confrontation, they gambled not only their available manpower, but something more important, their political prestige as a revolutionary force, able to defy by skillful evasion and superior tactics the military colossus. And in losing the gamble, they lost the essential momentum, the high sense of popular anticipation, the bandwagon effect, on which the success of any political movement depends. Revolution is by definition a mass phenomenon. Greek, Malaya, the Philippines all illustrate the axiom that without mass participation, or at least popular support, there can be no revolution. The Hucks lost it. The Chinese in Malaya never had it, and the Greek communists threw it away. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today is the 3rd of September, 2018. It's a Monday. It's about 39 minutes after 8 a.m. Arizona time. We wrapped up our block of instruction in the first 30 minutes on what happened in Malaya and Greece and the Philippines, or what happens when the guerrillas are removed or remove themselves from the sea of people that they swim in. Have a couple of border things interesting that we had. It's no fun being an illegal alien. Thanks for taking the time to listen in today. And tell your friends about Liberty Tree Radio. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. As always, we dedicate this broadcast to Lily Grace Antoinette. And also our broadcast on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday starts at the same time, 8 a.m. Arizona time, but it goes for 2 hours each day. All warfare is based on deception. Therefore, when capable, feign incapacity. When active, inactivity. When near, make it appear that you're far away, or when far away, that you're near. Offer the enemy a bait to lure him, feign disorder, and strike. When he concentrates, prepare against him. Where he's strong, avoid him. Anger is general and confuse him. Pretend inferiority and encourage his arrogance. Keep him under his strain and wear him down. When he is united, divide him. Attack where he is unprepared. Sally out when he does not expect you. These are the strategist's key to victory. The quotation is taken from Sun Tzu's essay on the art of war, the oldest known writing on the subject, predating the Christian era by several centuries. The striking resemblance to the military axioms of Mao Zedong is no coincidence. Mao has studied Sun Tzu thoroughly and acknowledges his debt. Many of the Chinese general leaders' dicta are, in fact, mere paraphrases of those of the Art of War. Sun Tzu is quoted to make a point. It is that modern warfare is, in its most common usage, a cant phrase, indicative of the confusion of journalists and politicians who mistake technology for science. For despite the impressive technological innovations of the 20th century, the principles of warfare are not modern but ancient. They are well established when Caesar marched out on his first campaign. What is true of war in general is even more true, if possible, of guerrilla warfare in particular. Aircraft and artillery provide weapons of far greater range than the longbow. Explosive, formidably multiply the striking power of the arrow. Tanks are better than shields. Trucks and helicopters offer, but not always, swifter and more dependable transportation than mules and camels. The problems of generalship remain the same. The available factors of terrain, weather, space, time, population, and above all, of morale and strategy still determine the outcome of battles and campaigns. Because if there is anything new about guerrilla war, of which Sun Tzu surprisingly anticipates by 2,000 years virtually all questions of military nature, it is only in the modern political application. To put it another way, the specifically modern aspect of guerrilla war is in its use as a tool of political revolution, the single sure method by which an unarmed population can overcome mechanized armies, or failing to overcome them, can stalemate them and make them irrelevant. And to understand how this comes about does not require a study of military tactics so much as the political problems to which military methods, guerrilla methods, may provide a solution. The guerrilla is a political insurgent, the conscious agent of revolution. His military role, while vital, is only incidental to his political mission. His insurgency is dedicated to a single purpose, the overthrow of the government and the destruction of the existing political or social will. It may be economic system. Now, in the process of accomplishing his goal, he may have to defeat, and he will certainly have to engage and outmaneuver organized professional military forces. If so, however, his maneuvers, except where immediate survival is at stake, will be undertaken primarily for their political effect. Each battle will be a lesson designed to demonstrate the impotence of the army and so to discredit the government that employs it. Each campaign will be a text intended to raise the level of the revolutionary awareness and anticipation of the popular majority whose attitude will determine the outcome of the struggle. Guerrilla actions will have certain obvious military objectives: to obtain weapons, ammunition, and supplies, to inflict casualties, to force the enemy to overextend his line so that his communications may be disrupted and small units picked off, one at a time, by local superior rebel forces. But psychologically and political objectives will be paramount. Local military success will serve no purpose if the guerrilla campaign does not also weaken the morale of the government and its soldiers, strain the financial resources of the regime, and increase the political pressure on it by creating widespread apprehension and dissatisfaction with the progress of the war, in which there is no progress and no end in sight. Now, obviously, none of this can occur except in the presence of a certain distinct social and political conditions, which combine to produce a potentially revolutionary situation. Successful insurgencies presuppose the existence of valid popular grievances, sharp social divisions, an unsound or stagnant economy, or oppressive government. Now, these factors obtain, revolutionary will still be far off. unless there exists or comes into existence the nucleus of a revolutionary organization capable of articulating and exploiting popular dissatisfaction with the status quo. Now, ordinarily, however, revolutionary situations produce their own revolutionary leadership. Coming from the most unstable social sectors, it can be expected to include the most radical, most frustrated, and ambitious elements of the political out parties, the more idealistic and least successful members of the middle class, and those most outraged by the unaccustomed pinch of oppression. The long tyrannized peasants, for example, is seldom a revolutionary as the relative fortunate student or worker who have been led to believe that he has rights and finds in a change of political climate that he is deprived of them. Now, in the potentially revolutionary situation, spontaneous insurrections may be expected. They are likely to arise out of almost any sort of social conflict, a strike, an election campaign, a dispute over land or wages or prices or rents or schools or any one of a score of other social problems. Often they will come in reaction to some sort of repression or a real or fancied injustice on the part of the governing authorities as, for example, when the efforts of the police to curb a popular demonstration turn the demonstration into a riot. Now, in other circumstances, disorder may be deliberately created in Cuba, Algeria, Cyprus, as examples that come readily to mind. The War of the Flea was initiated by the deliberate acts of the revolutionary nucleus, proclaiming its defiance of authority and banking on popular support and an open declaration of revolutionary war. Now, the means are not important. The important element is the leadership itself. Bandits are not revolutionaries. Looters are not guerrillas. In order to attract the following, the revolutionary leaders must stand on firm moral grounds. They must have some greater purpose than the furtherance of personal ambitions. And this, in turn, replies an ideology or a clear cause to explain their decisions and reasons for their insurgency. They cannot be mere opportunists. When the conflict occurs, whether spontaneous or induced, the revolutionary leaders must be capable of explaining and rationalizing its confused and often apparently accidental character. Isolated acts of defiance must be given coherence within the revolutionary frame of reference. The leadership must be prepared to make the most of every opportunity to accelerate the process of social ferment and political disruption. The first task of the revolutionary cadre must be to relate each incident and each phase of the conflict to a greater cause so that revolutionary violence is seen as the natural and moral means to the desired end and the masses of the people are increasingly involved. The struggle cannot be allowed to seem meaningless or chaotic. It must be given a progressive character in all its phases. It must arouse great expectations and appear crucial at every stage so that no one can stand outside of it. I see we've got about 10 minutes or so left on today's broadcast. But now you're starting to see. When we first started off talking about what insurgency was, we've gone into studying a lot of case studies, Cuba, Malaya, the Philippines, French Indochina, and a lot of the leaders and the thought processes and the strategy, the tactics, techniques, and procedures of where they were coming from. And now we've kind of looped back to explain and to hammer home the point that insurgency is not militarily, it's a political upheaval. And that's why I'm trying to tell you that your guns are your most worthless piece of equipment. I try to get some people motivated, and they're like, well, you see, I'm not a political subversive. I really don't care about that stuff. I'm going to sit here on my couch and polish my rifle and count my bullets. And I'm a guerrilla fighter, and when the time comes, I'm going to take up arms. Okay, that's kind of what we've got. That's okay. Trying to reinvent the wheel over and over again. They just don't seem to get it. But that's okay. We all come to a better understanding at different times. But first we have to learn to crawl before we can walk, before we can run. Borderlandbeat.com, 18 August 2018, 4 killed and 9 injured during attacks at 6 Monterey bars. At least 4 people were killed and 9 wounded in a series of attacks against 6 bars in different parts of Monterey, Nuevo León. The bar attacks simultaneously were El Masano woman and black, located on Lincoln Avenue in the Colonia San Jorge. The bars were no more than 200 meters away from each other. According to a police source, a valet at the parking lot at El Manceo was executed in the parking lot of the shopping plaza located at Lincoln Avenue in the Graciano Botoni neighborhood. There was a woman of South American origin was wounded about 100 meters away in a strip club called Woman, located in the San Jorge neighborhood. 3 people were shot, 2 males and a female. It was reported that Cynthia Vega Simone, 33, who works as a dancer, suffered a bullet in the abdomen, while a male identified as Antonio Cruz Morales, 46, was shot in the left leg. The source said the attacks were apparently committed by the same armed men. In the black bar, there were only shots to the facade, police sources said. Borderlandbeat.com, 18 August 2018. Reynosa, shootout and chase ends with 6 killed. A chase by Tamaulipas State Police officers and an armed group in Reynosa ended with 6 people killed. The events occurred minutes after 2 p.m. when anonymous calls reported that there was a shootout between the southbound gaps, apparently between rival criminal cells. The commanders mobilized agents of the sector in that area, and when they were traveling through Reynosa Viaduct, they came face to face with an armed group, and a confrontation took place on the Puerto del Sol Avenue crossing. According to versions of the agents that participated in the confrontation, they killed 5 armed men and 1 woman who accompanied them in a compact Nissan Versa car and a Mitsubishi truck. The site, located in the south of the city, was guarded by agents of several corporations, including military and of the 8 Zone, who came in support. From about 300 meters before arriving at the scene, federal police cordoned off the area, preventing access by the press by waiting for the arrival of staff from the prosecution and expert services, the Attorney General of the state. Borderlandbeat.com, 19 August 2018, Ensenada, Baja California. Soldiers find 750 kilos of crystal, fentanyl, and marijuana in the undergrowth. Soldiers of the Mexican Army seized approximately 750 kilos of crystal, fentanyl, and marijuana hidden in the undergrowth on the municipality of Ensenada, Baja California. The drugs were found on a dirt road that begins at kilometer 78 of the Trans-Peninsular Federal Highway Number 1. The soldiers seized 75 black plastic bags secured with tape containing various drugs. There was also 468 plastic packages weighing 60 grams each of crystal, in addition to 30 other plastic bags of crystal. Several plastic containers of 1 kilo each of fentanyl each, 2 plastic containers with 4,000 fentanyl pills, and 46 of 10 kilos each of marijuana. MotorlandBeat.com, 21 August 2018. Vancouver man with gang link slain in Guadalajara. A West Vancouver man associated with Hell's Angels has been shot to death in Mexico. Post Media News has learned Giuseppe Bug, 42, died of a hail of bullets Thursday night in a posh shopping center in an exclusive neighborhood of Guadalajara, Mexico. Local news reports said three vehicles pulled up at about 9:30 p.m. and between 8 and 10 men jumped out and fired at Bug, who has a long history of fraud in Baja California. More than 140 bullets were fired at him, killing him instantly and injuring one of his Mexican-American associates, later died, and two bystanders. Jalisco prosecutor Raul Sanchez Jimenez said at a press conference that the state government had asked the Canadian-American consulates for information about Bug and the injured man. Sergeant Brenda Winpenny of the Combined Forces Special Enforcement Unit said Bug is known to police in this province. He is associated with Hell's Angels and involved in drug trafficking, Winpeg said. Global Affairs Canada said in a statement that the federal government is providing consular service to the victim's family. We offer our deepest condolences to the family and friends of the Canadian citizen who has been murdered in Mexico, Brittany Fletcher said in an email. Oh boy, you know what happens then. Something happens here, something happens there. It's on like Donkey Kong. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's just scraping the surface of what's been going on in Mexico. There's been some things happening in the last month that's not been real good around here. It's just been one thing after the other, and something else happened yesterday morning, and things are just really tough. So,
hey, Mike.
Yes.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Anyway, to speak to what you were saying earlier on the insurgency, it brought to mind that the information that needs to be passed on to the subversives who are looking to eliminate a criminal syndicated government or individuals in the government so they can restore some type of order or effect drastic change. A lot of that assumes that there are good lines of communication, and what I'm getting at is if you cannot rely on conventional or the accepted mainstream media, then the insurgents or subversive activities must have a very good way of communicating successes and not necessarily failures, because then you fall into propaganda there. You know, you don't necessarily want to speak of your failures, but you have to have that type of media outlet, and that so that would assume that the events would be reported contemporaneously and accurately and disseminated to the mass audience. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Absolutely. We've been kind of touching on the insurgent use of the media, the broadcast, and the internet. You use the example of the Zapatistas in Mexico in the early 2000s.
Well, thanks, Mike.
Hey, no sweat. Where are we at? Well, today is the 3rd of September, 2018. It's a Monday, top of the hour here. That means that's the end of the broadcast. Next week we'll get back to this question about disseminating the information about the successes on the guerrilla. Yeah, very good question. Too bad we ran out of time here. On Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. and got a little bit of border news. Please tell your friends about Liberty Tree Radio and the Micro Effect. I'll see you next week.
Dancing lesson to the jitterbug rat.